Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I'm Tyler Bishop, joined today again by your good friend, Producer Manny. Producer Manny.
Hey, I'm back.
Manny is a jack of all trades. I really don't know how he does it. He's managing multiple monitors, screens, audio, and still finds time to weigh in on all the different topics that we talk about here on The Publisher Lab. I've really been enjoying sort of the flow that we've had recently. I think that one of the things that's been really fun is seeing how the show evolves and then the feedback from all of you. So if you listen to the show or enjoy listening to the show because we cover things that are topical, things that have happened this week, usually the top articles and news and information in the world of publishing, stuff that affects people that run websites and things along those lines. If you really enjoy this stuff, it would be great just to get more feedback. We talked about this a few weeks ago when we said that, you know, web publishers need to be, you know, interacting with audiences as much as they can. And, you know, we've really let your feedback guide the show. And so we hope that'll continue to be the case. You can go to publisherlab.org and give us your feedback and any questions that you have. And that would be amazing because I love answering questions. And then, yeah, feedback, we take it. So just kind of hopping right into things. One of the first, you know, kind of areas that we like to cover on the show is sort of the advertising industry, since it's the lifeblood for digital publishing in a lot of respects. If you look back historically, thousands of years, really centuries and centuries of, I mean, pretty much the history of written content. So, it's been fueled by advertising more so than any other model, and it's proven to work because you have three parties that win. You know, you have your reader who wants content for free, you have the publisher who provides content, and then you have the advertisers that subsidize all the costs that are associated with that. And so right now going on in industry news, we have, you know, the anatomy of ad tech. And this comes from Digiday. So there was an article this week, and you could go back probably 3 or 4 years and you could find this exact same article, almost verbatim. And it's called The Anatomy of Ad Tech Outrage by Digiday. And the advertising community is basically, they're upset over an outrage that's basically made for advertising content on the web. So you can think of this as basically websites that are spun up specifically for the only reason being to monetize them. And they don't really, I was reading through the story, Producer Manny, they don't really go into specifically what that means, because this is something I actually talked to a reporter at Digiday a while back, and they were talking about spammy sites. And I was like, well, what is a spammy site? And what they described was, it was a little bit arbitrary because it was subjective. So I don't know, when you hear made for advertising website, what do you think of?
I'm thinking about like a website that just has a ton of ads on it, maybe not the most like exciting or relevant or even good content, but just somewhere where they can just throw a bunch of ads on there and just make money off of it.
Yeah, I think so. I'm always jaded whenever people will use these sort of like broader terms in the industry, because I have a hard time putting myself in the from the perspective of either a general member of the public or even somebody that's not quite as jaded by the advertising ecosystem over a couple decades. And so when I look at that, I can think of two things. I can think of somebody that is started running a website specifically just because they want to make money. You can think of it almost like as an investor. And that doesn't necessarily eliminate the, you know, the quality of the content from being, you know, like if you make great content, nobody's doing this purely for free for the most part. A lot of people start for free, but, over time when this starts to become a business, you want to make money off of it. So, what I'm assuming that they're talking about specifically, more so than anything else is kind of this new hybrid arbitrage. It's not new. Arbitrage has been around for a long time, where you basically almost trick people into clicking links on social sites and things like that. And then they come to the website and then you show them more ads than it costs to get the click or whatever. That kind of went extinct a while back. But there is sort of this like kind of hybrid in between, where you have sites that are essentially picking, you know, keywords and things like that that they think that they can get ranked for, and using AI to spin up the content. So you have what is pretty generic, low quality content populating on the web, and then, you know, people trying to make a quick buck off of it. To me, there's not a lot of profit in it. You know, like, even if AI just generates the most generic thing ever, but it ranks number one for a certain term or something like that, there's a pretty good chance that that query or that term didn't have any other good answers, or nobody had made content for it. So I think that this is a lot of hand wringing and a lot of finger pointing going on across the industry at what is not the problem. The problem is not that the internet has too much spammy content in it. It would be more so that the spammy content would populate to the top. And that's really isn't the case. If you look at all the studies that are out there, generally the overall quality of content served in search results and pretty much across the entire web, you know, quality in terms of content, not necessarily like production, but I don't know, producer Manny, am I wrong on this? Am I off base? Do you think that content on the internet's gotten worse?
I feel like content on the internet has always kind of stayed equally spammy. It's just more about the creativity and the new methods that they use, right?
Yeah, I agree with that. And you know, I think that this kind of speaks to a larger point, which, again, you know, it's funny how this industry operates in cycles, but this is coming from Adweek, but they had an article this week on, it was called Publisher Adoption for New Video Ad Specs Lags 6 Months After Introduction. So this is another thing where it's like, if you go back probably 6-7 years, you had this big issue where Facebook was overcounting, I believe, the number of views on Facebook Watch. So you had a lot of advertisers and even publishers. I remember, I think BuzzFeed was one of the ones that was really upset about this and maybe had a lawsuit filed against Meta, or formerly Facebook. And it was all based on the fact that they literally hired these big video teams and people were spending a lot more money on video because Facebook had inflated the amount of views that these videos were getting. And now I think everybody should hopefully know better than to trust a platform's metrics on something that they have an incentive to inflate. But despite that, I think that we're sort of seeing that again, where you've got publishers and advertisers, they're struggling to adopt new forms of video ad classifications and things along those lines. And that lack of symmetry that you're seeing, that's because essentially you have publishers and advertisers that both want some sort of formatting or standard that they can base costs, pricing, that sort of thing off of. And, you know, not having something like that creates a almost like a vacuum where there's this big disparity between somebody that gets it right and somebody that gets it wrong. So a lot of this has been introduced in March, some of the, you know, new specs that they've been trying to get to take hold. But a lot of it's been hindered by unclear sort of like whose responsibility it is for, you know, ensuring adoption. There's not really a lot of financial incentives, you know, in terms of like a community-based incentive. And then just also who is supporting this, like who is ensuring that these types of things are evolving and actually like working. And so I think what you're going to find is that there's very few parties in the space outside of those with significant vertically integrated businesses that may or may not be against the law that have any, you know, interest in doing anything with this, because you have concerns about basically trying to manage all of it and take the lead on it. And there's just everybody in the space is kind of out for themselves a little bit from the standpoint of why would I invest so much time and energy in trying to like collectively bargain what this is, because universally, what you're going to find is that advertisers and publishers are a little bit sort of on different sides of the fence on this sort of thing. And so you are going to probably get for a long time now this big disparity between, you know, publisher to publisher. The video advertising that you have on your site could, you know, vary quite considerably depending on how it's configured and what the demand even is for your types of topics or audience. So like you can think of this as, you know, me and Manny both have websites. I have one on golf. He has one on, I don't know, fly fishing. And you would think that, you know, we have largely similar audiences. Maybe his is all from Montana. Mine is all from Texas. And because of that, maybe I have a lot of video demand and he doesn't. And so maybe we make the same amount of money because I don't even have the right formats available on my website. Okay. But I changed the formats. Now I make a lot more money. Now he sees me doing that. He changes the formats on his, maybe gets another ad partner, but his doesn't go up. And it's just, you know, you don't know, is it the demand or is it the standard? And yeah, that's one of the things that I don't imagine changing anytime soon, but it gives you an idea of sort of like what types of things matter and what you can ignore whenever people start proselytizing that these things are going to solve those types of problems. Let's see, moving on, what else do we have in terms of, I think that kind of leaves us for our advertising news for the week. I will say this, in relation to, ad news for the week is I think that the advertising ecosystem has been polluted for a long time. And if you read everything that, you know, like all the made Adweek, Digiday, whoever, and you listen to the big brand publishers, you know, they bang their fists on the desk, every year, and they complain about the same problems. And one of two things: either A, they don't have the interest in solving any problems and they want somebody else to do it, or B, they don't have the power to. And I think that it's a little bit of A and a little bit of B, but I do caution our listeners, who I don't think are largely you know, working at Complex or anything like that. I would say that you should not necessarily take the lead from big brands and assume that, you know, they're representing your interests, because from what I've found over the years is that brand publishers are largely concerned with a lot of things that are, you know, in some ways arbitrary or not all that important to the actual business. And so I think for publishers, it's really good to sort of like keep your ear to the ground and worry about your best interests and what types of things actually are going to affect your business. You know, video ad standards and things like that, I don't think are a huge concern for most independent publishers. Looking forward into social media news in the week. So, you know, when you talk about social media news, it's pretty hard not to find X, or formerly Twitter, in the news. And this article comes from TechCrunch. X's privacy policy confirms it will use public data to train AI models. Now, producer ManAI, he brought this up to me right before we started the podcast. And just to give you a little context on this before we get into it. So they updated the privacy policy. It was for all platform users. And basically what they said is that they're going to start collecting everything from biometric data. Now that's a little concerning, to job history. You know, you can assume all the content that's in there and other public data. And, you know, is this, you know, potentially Elon's entry into the AI market? I would argue that Twitter is one of maybe five places online that have, you know, exponential amounts of unique data and content that would be extremely valuable for AI moving into the future. And so, yeah, I think the writing was on the wall when they cut their API access off to developers a couple months ago. It was pretty obvious that this was the reason why, is that they didn't want somebody else to build an entire enterprise and, you know, maybe the next megalithic big tech company off of Twitter's data. So they're going to do it themselves. So producer Manny, you mentioned before, like, is it good for AI to get the information for you? You can rephrase the question how you did, because I think it was the right one.
Yeah, so I guess the question that I was raising, and I might be jumping forward a little bit here, but we also have a story about CNN and a lot of large publications where they are trying to stop web crawlers and AI from taking their information. However, on the other side of the fence, we see Elon and X saying, yeah, we're going to use everyone's tweets to train AI. So I think the concern here is like the quality of information that the AI will be trained on. Is that something that we should be concerned with? And then that also kind of brings in the misinformation, because Twitter is full of it. So which way do we go?
Yeah, and I, you know, the thing that I think maybe I surprised you with before we started the show was I said I would much rather have all the data be fed in from Twitter than from, you know, like a CNN or a major media company. Take you know, what you might think about all the major news networks here in the U.S. aside, the more information, the better. So the benefit of AI that we can think of at the moment is really that its ability to sort of like pull in lots of information and then calculate it quickly, much faster than a human. So you can think about it as, it would you rather basically have a human filter this information for you, or would you rather have a machine that has far less flaws and biases and things like that, and know exactly how the information is filtered back to you versus, you know, it's a human being and, you know, it's based on their decisions and things along those lines. Now, Twitter is filled with, you know, everything when you can think of, you know, you think of it, bad, good, whatever, it's in there. But you kind of want that too, because what if all the, you know, like even hateful, you know, disparaging content or something like that, wouldn't you want to know, like, where is this coming from? Like, what types of people are taking in this information, and what kinds of things are they saying? Because this is the type of thing that can actually like create content in of itself. So you think about, you learn that, you know, a huge portion of the population thinks the earth is flat, and we're getting way off on a tangent here, but, you know, why is it that they think that? It's all people from, you know, certain background, and they have, you know, some, all these X, Y, Z things in common. And like, that gives you information to be able to then communicate with people like that, in ways that you probably couldn't have ever before. And I think personalization is a big part of where maybe Twitter might go with something like this. I don't know, Manny, are you convinced? Have I brought you over, or are you still a little bit skeptical?
I think I'm going to still be skeptical. I feel like, especially with gathering all this data, especially with like biometric data.
Biometric data is concerning. That's yeah. A different thing, because, you know, we're talking about like how AI can basically take in all the data and information like in tweets and then maybe parse that through. But then when you start thinking about, like, it mentions job history, education history, biometric data, that's a little concerning from the standpoint of, you know, a change in the terms and conditions. You know, I'm still like dumbfounded that all these tech companies for so long have got away with just being able to like check this box, and, you know, now you agree to whatever we say. And then being able to just like send you an email and say, oh, we updated it. Well, like in this case, this is a huge difference, you know, saying that I allow Twitter to, you know, like have my content that I put into it in the form of tweets, and having Twitter being able to genetically identify me out of a lineup are two different things. One of those things I might be willing to sign up for, the other probably not. So pretty concerning, and one that I imagine, if used in practice, will probably come under legal challenge.
I also just want to add too that it was mentioned that because this is X and Elon Musk that's working on this, Tesla and his other firms are going to be very closely working together with this. So even like if you're sitting in your Tesla, you know, there's like a million cameras on the Tesla, they're going to have all that information. They're going to be able to feed the AI.
Yeah. And I think that this is something that we all need to be probably kind of aware of from the standpoint of, over the last decade, we've gone through this amazing transformation where the cloud and lightweight technologies have allowed the collection of more data than what pretty much any, you know, system or human can know what to do with. And all this data has sort of been collected by every tech company. I mean, every tech company I've ever worked for or built, we've collected way more data than we needed, with the idea of like, we're saving it for a rainy day. You might want this someday. But the point of wanting it someday is that eventually you would find, you know, systems or something that's smart that could take that data and then provide analysis or give direction based on it. And over the last decade, we've had unprecedented amounts of consumer and personal data collected by a lot of companies. And now we're going to find out, you know, what is and isn't legal to have done with that data. And yeah, I think it is definitely something that if it slides by people too quickly, you may not like kind of like where this ends up. But I imagine it'll spend a decent amount of time in courtrooms before then. And I'll go ahead and kind of skip over some of the, so there was a recent article in Digiday about X's brand safety and an upheaval there. That is something that's really common in advertising, is sort of this concern about quote unquote brand safety, having ads appear next to, you know, extremist content or even just volatile content that maybe a brand doesn't want to agree with. And I think that this is a, I've never seen this have an impact actually on advertising performance, both personally and then just you can look across the studies that have been done. It's pretty rare that advertising, you know, being associated with, you know, especially when it's programmatic, if I see a commercial on TV for Pepsi and it's, you know, on some R-rated movie that I wouldn't want my children to watch or something like that, I don't immediately go, kids, we're not drinking Pepsi anymore because look, they support R-rated movies. The same goes for like display ads and all kinds of ads on the internet, I think. I do think that brands maybe feel an impact or like an upheaval from customers a lot of times whenever, you know, maybe they're supporting somebody specifically where it's like Pepsi sponsors, I don't know, Putin, you know. I would imagine that wouldn't be too popular, and especially in the West. So I do think that this is probably overblown to some extent. The one thing I will say about it, though, is that when a brand is investing money, especially in something programmatically, and they do get pushback from their audience or their consumers where people are like, Pepsi, how dare you support, you know, InfoWars was a big one a while back. Alex Jones pretty much made it impossible for him to basically get monetized after a long time. But for a while, when Google and others still allowed display ads on his site, people would, you know, sort of like go at the brands that, you know, still ran ads in there. And, you know, realistically, it's not even the ads. They just didn't have them blacklisted as a site. So what you find is that somebody that is an audience member of InfoWars or something like that, they go and they visit Pepsi's website and they come back to InfoWars or wherever. And then they see those Pepsi ads on there. And so it has more to do with the person that's actually seeing the ads than it does the publisher or the advertiser. And I think people largely get that. But what brands hear are the loud voices from the activists. So there are people and organizations that are out there that specifically go around and sort of like try to get different sources demonetized by like protesting to the brands. And so that's really where most of this comes from. And that's why you never see anything done about it in reality. And then finally, moving on to our favorite, AI news. So we went AI last this time, and I think it's probably appropriate because it's in every single episode where we kind of go through what's the latest. And I figured we'd start with some, you know, some vanilla, the things that we know, you know, social media, advertising, you know, these things that have been around for a while that haven't been completely replaced by the robots just yet. And speaking of being replaced by robots, so ChatGPT's reach is limited among U.S. adults. So this comes from Search Engine Journal. And just whenever we thought the robots were going to take over, all the sort of like analytics that you're seeing now around like the, you know, kind of linear adoption of ChatGPT and sort of like its peak potential and this big explosion that everybody has been watching and then also expecting to continue as sort of like it's ramping down a bit. And Manny, I don't really know exactly why this is, but I do know that, you know, like I can look around in my own life, people that are completely disconnected from, you know, the technology space. Like my wife, for example, I think she's used ChatGPT one time and it was because I was like, you should use ChatGPT to do this. Is this kind of what you're finding in your life as well?
It's funny because we're kind of in the same situation. My wife won't really touch it unless it's like very important or if it's like, oh, I can write like Instagram descriptions with this.
Yeah.
So I do hear about less and less people using it. I know that there was a big concern and fuss, especially within the graphic design community early on. But as time has gone on, I feel like that concern has lessened. I feel like more and more people are seeing it as a tool rather than a replacement. And a lot of the times it's, you know, if you need a very, very specific image or if you have something in your head, 9 times out of 10, unless like you're hyper descriptive, you probably won't be able to get AI to give you the image that you're looking for. And even if it kind of does it, it's still not perfect enough, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that, you know, I've found that, you know, I've become a better user of the different forms of AI. And, you know, I have a level of technical expertise where I'm able to sort of like kind of piece together different frameworks and things like that and largely, you know, do a week's worth of work in a day in many cases. And I think that that's the potential that it has, but I don't know that it's necessarily approachable enough for every person. And because, you know, like, unless you work in a job that there's an obvious application, consumer behavior traditionally, and this is sort of like the big thing with search engines as well right now, where these sort of like forward-looking like disruptions that you can imagine or everybody has a theory on, these are going to actually take a lot more time than what you might assume. And the reason is because even though like you can see how ChatGPT is going to disrupt, you know, the modern search engine right now, and maybe it, and in fact, it is in some cases, especially among early adopters, by the time that some of these people that we're talking about now, producer Manny and I, where we're talking about like, you know, my wife, for example, or whoever, to get those people brought over to where it's like their, you know, their behavior is disrupting a search engine by using ChatGPT instead, we're a little ways away from that. And I think that it's because those populations have to be able to find, you know, practical uses and use cases to sort of like what they call on-ramp to a new technology or behavior. So I do think that one of the things that we can kind of take away from this is that all the metrics in the world are telling us that, you know, sort of like this big takeover that AI was going to have in disrupting the web. Not necessarily that it won't occur, but that maybe we all have a little bit more time than what was initially thought. And then our last story for the day from Axios, major websites are blocking AI crawlers from accessing their content. So this is sort of like a lot of people taking a page out of the X book, Manny. So remember me saying a little bit earlier that they cut up their developer API access, which had been free for the longest time, which is kind of crazy, actually. And they're basically hiding their content from AI crawlers and crawler bots and things like that. And the reason is because, you know, if an AI can come to your website and take its content, you know, just because it's really stealing. It's like licensing. It's like why the actors are mad that, you know, ChatGPT can take a writer's job or whatever. It's not that AI can't write. It's that, you know, if you ask it to write the, you know, 11th season, I don't know, I'll pick a show that I actually do watch that has seasons. Maybe now I don't know the number of the seasons of the different shows. Let's see, Succession, right? So Succession, I think it's supposed to be over, right? Manny, did you watch the show?
I didn't know.
So I think Successions, you guys get it. I think it did 3 seasons and it should be like, it should be finished now. But let's say you wanted to write a 4th season and got the actors on board, but you didn't want to hire any writers. Well, the source material for what would happen next in the story arc is going to come from the 3 seasons that were written by people. So you're using and piggybacking off of all their labor for, you know, something that's fresh and new. And so if your website can basically get like pillaged by AI to regurgitate sort of that content, or even just like use it as a baseline for creating new content, that has pretty large ramifications, because you're basically allowing these large organizations and big tech to you know, get free labor. You know, like training an AI model is really hard. It's why it's taken so long to get a ChatGPT. It's a lot of feedback from real users. I'd heard that they'd had people in warehouses basically just training bots on whether or not, you know, an answer was semantically correct for communicating with humans for a long period of time. So this stuff is not easy. And so now you have crawlers that are basically being blocked by a lot of websites. But if we're going to be honest, this is going to save websites from OpenAI. It's going to save them from, you know, like Google or whoever, because they will obey these because they'll be worried about legal concerns. The thing that we should be concerned about with this is what AI is out there that is not going to obey that. Because crawlers, unless you ban visitors from your site, a crawler can pretty much do everything that a regular visitor could do. And there's really no great way other than measuring sort of like the data like extracted or like the energy expended from, you know, like a session or a user agent or something like that. So it gets pretty complex whenever you try to block it. And, you know, if a lot of people decide to block it, it can just change sort of its parameters and its behaviors, and it could get past that. So it's a game of cat and mouse that publishers can't win. And I think that the concern that we should all have is basically, you know, like if somebody without your knowledge takes your content and then doesn't even regurgitate it necessarily, but then uses that as sort of like knowledge that it's acquired to create new content. Well, that's the value that humans do provide, is that the machines out of the box have no information. They're zero. And so humans collect the information, and, you know, like you or me or whoever, we're experts on things and we write about it and we create that content. Well, what happens then whenever, you know, like somebody else comes along and wants to steal your expertise, you know? I've heard before with both acting and writing, what you're going to start to see is, you know, databases pop up that are largely designed so that users can, these artists or the writers or whoever, people that, you know, create content for a living or have their likeness associated with content, you're going to see these databases start to pop up where you can chuck your content into a database where it'll cross-check it against, you know, different models and information that's in them. And you'll be able to say, like, if you want to use, you know, my content in your model or whatever, you'll have to license it from me. And I think that's a lot easier in practice when you start talking about, like, you know, likenesses and things like that. But written content's going to be a little bit different. And I think this is probably the first area where you'll see AI get regulated, some kind of, you know, adoption of standards where, you know, like it's very easy to tell, and also some form of protection for sites and things like that. I mean, the web kind of has this now, right? Like you've got websites. You ever see the little copyright thing down at the bottom of a website, Producer Manny?
Yeah. I definitely have.
The reason for that is because they're basically letting you know it would be illegal to copy the source code to that website or application and then use it like it, as if it was your own. And that's something that largely people have abided by the law on, and the law has done a good job of sort of like, judicial like review and judicial consequences for it. So I'm a little bit optimistic here that, yeah, I do think that we're going to run into some, you know, like sticky examples in the meantime. But until then, I think, you know, I think this is something that's solvable, at least solvable in the sense that we've got solutions now that are not too dissimilar. But that's it that we've got for news today in terms of all the stuff that we run down. I enjoy really kind of like digging into these topics a little bit more and staying up with the news of the day. But if there are topics or there's just kind of general directions that you'd like to see us go with the show, one of the things that I've considered a couple of times is I discover all kinds of new AI tools and revelations about how to use it almost every day. And I've thought about doing an episode where I just run through some of them and why you should check those out. But I really want your feedback. So if you have a chance, leave us a question or give us some feedback, or if that's an episode that sounds interesting to you, go to publisherlab.org. Otherwise, you can keep watching on YouTube or listening wherever you get your podcast to The Publisher Lab.